Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, we talk about our emotional responses to COVID-19 and the stay-at-home orders we are living through with Fresno author Armin Bacon. And today is decision day for many colleges, so we check in with some high school seniors to find out what it's like to decide on your future in the middle of a pandemic. But first, it's hard enough for any kid to shelter in place. They can't go to school, do team sports, or physically hang out with their friends. But for foster kids already struggling to maintain relationships, social distancing can be even more challenging. Valley Public Radio's Laura Satsui has this report.
Renee is 15 years old, loves fantasy and romance novels, and wants to be a social worker when she grows up.
I want to be that social worker that actually cares.
The kind, she says, who will do whatever it takes to help foster kids. So far, she's worked with 8 different social workers. She says she only really liked one of them. We're calling Renee by her middle name because she's a minor in the foster system. And she says the pandemic makes being a foster kid even more difficult.
I wish people understood that it's not easy. It's hard being away from your family and your friends mostly.
She's been with her current foster family for about 4 months, and she likes them. But she really misses her family. Since shelter in place, she hasn't seen her 3 younger brothers who live with her grandma.
My brother, he just asked me the other day, he's like, when are you coming over? And I was just like, I don't know.
And of course, she hasn't been to her school, Fresno High, in weeks.
Foster kids that are in group homes or foster homes, their only escape was school. I mean, I might not have liked school, but I know it was good for me.
Renee is one of Fresno Unified's nearly 800 students in foster care. Tamani Heights is a manager with the district's Department of Prevention and Intervention. She oversees staff that work with foster students every day.
A lot of times for our foster students, school is their safe haven, and so they have the ability to check in with their social worker whenever they needed to or whenever they feel like they were having a rough day.
Instead, her social workers have been calling students to check in, but they say it's harder to establish an emotional connection by phone. Social workers with Fresno County are also doing virtual visits, says Trisha Gonzalez, Deputy Director of Child Welfare Services. Over the past 6 weeks, they've done over 3,000 video chats.
I'm seeing that our staff are trying to check in more regularly, really have good in-depth conversations, make sure that if there's a need, that we're doing what we can to fill that need.
But social workers are first responders too, Gonzalez says. If they get a call about abuse, they have to don protective gear and investigate as safely as possible.
We're doing things like taking pictures of paperwork instead of like trading pens back and forth, trying to do as much of the interview as they can from 6 feet away, but they still have to go into the houses to do their investigation. If there's a removal of children, of course, there's the close physical contact.
However, with schools closed, the department has received far fewer calls than usual. Teachers are mandated reporters, so if they suspect a child is being neglected or abused, they have to call Child Protective Services. And that's not happening as much now.
March is usually our highest month of the year. And the first couple weeks of March, we were close to setting records with the numbers we were getting. And then it was if we were on summer vacation.
This concerns Jason Williams, too. He spent over 20 years working with foster youth and is now a consultant and co-founder of Brainwise Solutions.
One of the main factors that helps kids in foster care is ongoing, consistent relationships. So I think in this current crisis with this physical distancing, it's having an impact on all of us, but I think it's going to have more of an impact on kids who already struggle to develop and maintain relationships.
It's certainly having an impact on the foster student we heard from at the beginning of this story. Renee is trying to stay in touch with friends, though. She's president of her school's foster kids club, and they're scheduling video chats. But still, she's ready for this to be over.
The first thing we're going to do is I'm going to go to my best friend's house. We're going to go to the mall. I'm going to get some matching outfits.
And she says she'll finally get to see her younger siblings. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. This week, throughout the Valley, calls to lift the stay-at-home order grew louder among some elected officials, business leaders, and even two Bakersfield physicians. So how are public health officials reacting to the growing push to reopen local economies? To find out, I spoke with Kern County Public Health Department epidemiologist Kimberly Hernandez and Public Information Officer Michelle Corson.
Thank you both for being on this show. Can you just give us an update on the spread of COVID-19 in Kern County?
We continue to see cases being detected throughout Kern County. Our total case count continues to increase.
That makes sense. Can you give us a sense, though, about how many people have been tested at this point?
So at this point, we have received 893 positive test results. Those are all of our cases in Kern County. We've received an additional 6,534 negative results. And then we have 3,177 reports of suspected COVID cases that are still being reconciled with their negative results.
So, and I'm not sure if this is, if Kimberly or Michelle wants to take this next question, but of course, testing is the thing that everybody is talking about and concerned about. Can you just give us maybe a sense of what the testing situation in Kern County has been to date, and then what you anticipate moving forward will be the actions of the county to hopefully increase access to testing?
So this is Michelle. I'll start. I'm excited our county administrative office announced that there are three new community free testing sites that will be opening up next week. The details are still being finalized. And this is an exciting opportunity to make more testing available and convenient to our residents. And we're working through the state and the governor's office. And so we are happy that we're going to be able to present these new testing opportunities that are free to our residents. And so we don't have any, obviously, data on that yet. We think more will even come after that, but those are the ones we know about currently. And then Kim can address the testing that's been happening up to this point with all of our providers.
Yeah, so testing, you know, we know will continue to expand. Right now, the most common test is the molecular test, which is that, you know, NP swab that people talk about. That is, you know, available throughout our community. We do know that a lot of people have questions about antibody testing. At this time, you know, the antibody testing is still relatively new. There are few tests that have been reviewed and approved by the FDA under the emergency use authorization. So we have cautioned our healthcare providers to do their due diligence when selecting these tests and to also be cautious in their interpretation of these tests.
So can you speak a little bit about this idea of contact tracing? Is that something that the county has been engaging in at this point, or is it something that you anticipate you'll be doing more of, particularly as some of these stay-at-home directives start to lift and people start moving about the community more and testing becomes more widely available?
We have always performed the contact tracing since the beginning of, since the first cases in Kern County were detected. We have followed up with those cases. We have elicited those contacts, close contacts to the confirmed case, and notified those close contacts that they may have been exposed to a person with COVID-19. And so we have continued contact tracing throughout this illness.
And is that something you anticipate, and Michelle, this might be a question for you, do you anticipate the county investing in more of that, hiring people, expanding capacity in that area?
We do expect to continue to do all of the contact tracing that we've been doing. The whether or not we need to expand and what that looks like, you know, we'll just navigate that as it comes. But so, yeah, we're not concerned about that, but we definitely will continue what we've been doing.
Great. Thank you. So, Michelle, I'd like to stick with you. You know, Kern County got a lot of attention this week because of the two doctors out of Bakersfield who were citing their COVID-19 testing data as evidence that it's time to reopen the local economy. What was the county health department's response to what those two doctors had to say?
So we do not agree with them wanting to reopen now. We are taking very seriously the order of our governor, and now is the time to stay at home and practice social distancing and continue to follow that really important order. So as a county, we have continued stressing the importance of that. And, you know, as we continue to navigate through this, the governor has been fantastic about laying out, you know, the four phases recently of reopening and what that would look like. Engaging our community in some of those processes, our business community, and, you know, moving forward in a modified way in the future of kind of reopening, but reopening safely and under the guidance of our governor is the way we will definitely be proceeding.
You know, there's been a lot of pushback against the governor's directives here in communities throughout the Central Valley, including the city of Taft. Earlier this week, the city council there voted to reopen barbershops, hair salons, and other small businesses as early as Monday, May 4th. I guess my first question to you is, do they have the authority to do that?
So I will say, yesterday, myself and my director, Matt Constantine, had a very productive conversation with the mayor of Taft, David Knorr, regarding the letter he had submitted. It all moved fairly quickly. The media got involved in the conversation quickly, and we had a chance to speak with him and really kind of lay that foundation of his desire to work with us to take the steps safely to begin to look at reopening. And so we started those conversations, and we have every intention to work with them, and we're feeling good about that right now. And so we got some things cleared up yesterday. So I think moving forward, we just want to provide them the education and the guidance. But again, restating, this is the decision of our governor, and this is not a county decision, a city decision, but it is an order by our governor, and we can prepare, but we will wait until the governor's order, you know, allows these steps to start happening.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting pushback out of the Fresno City Council. We're getting pushback all throughout the valley. I'm just wondering if you're hearing or have any concerns about other cities in Kern County who may also attempt to reopen prior to the state's recommendation.
You know, our cities, we have many incorporated cities here within Kern County, and geographically we're spread out pretty far. Our cities, we've been communicating with them from almost day one when this health crisis struck. We've been on phone calls, we have gone out and spoken to them, and they have been fantastic, and there's been a real great collaboration going on with our cities. We understand the frustration. We understand what this is doing to businesses, and it is terribly stressful. So we understand that they are eager. We're hearing the same thing. There's steps that people can start taking now as far as what would it look like when the governor lifts the order. How could you do some modifications to start the reopening process, right? And so I think some of those conversations are starting, and they're eager. But we just continue to stress the importance. We're all in this together, but our guidance remains to follow the governor's order. And we're feeling good about that in the conversations we're having with our cities.
And what are those steps that you're communicating to cities?
Well, it's a lot of it is what was laid out in the roadmap. I don't know if you watched the governor's daily press conferences, but he's laid out a four-phased approach. And within that, he has indicated that businesses now can start considering what would it look like when it is safe to reopen, and some of these modifications that will, include social distancing, you know, potentially wearing masks, things like that, sanitizing, employee-related issues. If your employees are sick, what is your plan? Those are the things he outlined in his address. We are also encouraged, he said, within weeks, not months, is the expected time that some of these modifications can begin to happen. So that's why our message remains clear. We could be toward the finish line of the blanket stay-at-home order, but some of these modifications can be coming in weeks. That's why social distancing is so important right now, and staying home is so important right now. And that just continues to be our message.
And then Kimberly Hernandez, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. You know, so many people are frustrated. People are really eager for the economy to open, very concerned about what COVID-19 has done to the economy. What message do you have for those who are listening who are just fed up and ready for this to be over?
We understand how people are feeling. We are feeling it too. Our families are feeling it too. I think what we would like to reiterate is that these measures have helped lessen impact on our healthcare system, on our community, and we know that it is difficult, but we encourage people to continue them. We have seen around the world and other parts of the country what can happen, and we are all working as hard as we can together to avoid those types of dire situations. And so we each have someone in our community that we are trying to protect. We each know someone in those high-risk groups who are at risk of severe illness and potentially death. And so we really encourage people to hold fast and to continue their social distancing measures, to continue maintaining good hygiene practices, and to continue doing all of those things as we move forward, because we know that that has impacted our community in a good way, that has kept the number of cases down, that has kept the number of severe illness down, and we want to continue doing that because we all have people that we want to protect.
And then, Michelle, before we wrap up, I do want to ask you about another thing that happened recently. A group of 19 local lawyers and business people submitted a letter to the Kern County Board of Supervisors claiming that the stay-at-home directive is unconstitutional. How is the county responding to that allegation?
So, yeah, it was referred to our county administrative office and to our county council. And they actually have spoken to some of our local media on the matter. So at this point, it's kind of moved out of the public health ability to comment because it's become a legal conversation. So some of those have started, I know, and our county council has received the complaint and they are reviewing it. So that's about all we can really say at this time, that it's being reviewed by our county council.
Well, Kimberly Hernandez and Michelle Corson from the Kern County Department of Health, thank you so much for being on the show and for bringing us up to speed on what you're dealing with in Kern County.
Thank you. It's our pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today is college signing day for many students, although some universities have extended their deadlines. Valley Public Radio's news director Alice Daniel spoke with three seniors from the farming town of Woodlake about what it's like to make a decision when you can't even visit any campuses. All three seniors will be first-generation college students. Here are their stories.
My name is Selena Lopez-Curiel, and I applied to UC Davis, UC Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, UC Santa Cruz, Fresno State, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly Pomona, and San Jose State. All of them accepted me. I'm also an undocumented student, so when I mentioned that and how much I've accomplished, I think that's what made me stand out. I came to the United States in 2004. My mom works in the fields, and my dad is a gardener or a yard worker. Both of my parents are still working, but it is kind of, well, for me personally, I worry for them because they're still working and around other people when there's a disease going around. Well, my parents, they've supported me and whatever school I wanted to go to because they've always told me, like, work hard. We want you to have the opportunities that we didn't have. But because they don't know a lot about college, they haven't really been helping me make my college decision. I've been doing that on my own. Right now, especially for seniors, it's much harder because usually in the past, you could go visit schools and physically see what your choice is and see if that environment suits you and if you feel at home there. But now we can't really do that. Personally, I don't like online school. I prefer being in a classroom and interacting with others and working on assignments in the classroom. So for me, it's been hard because I don't learn online. I learn in a classroom environment. And me being a 4.0 student, I still want to keep up with my grades, but I feel like I'm not learning. Personally, I would want to experience that freshman experience of going to college and experiencing something new, being independent. And I am afraid that I'm not going to be able to do that because there's a pandemic going on and we have to take certain precautions in order for us to be safe. This pandemic situation is a whole new situation that I've never lived through. So it's complicated trying to figure out what I should be doing. I'm kind of scared, but then again, I'm also looking forward to the future because I know we're going to make it through this and I'm going to get a higher education, get my degree. So I'm trying to keep a positive outlook, even though right now the times aren't necessarily positive. Well, I want to do urban forestry and ornamental horticulture because I want to go more towards a plant science aspect. I'm going to UC Davis.
My name is Rogelio Chavez. I applied to 9 schools, that being UC Berkeley, UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, UC Davis, UC Santa Cruz, Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, Sacramento State, San Diego State, and CSU Channel Islands. And I got into all of those schools except for UCLA. I come from a low-income family, and we don't really have, like, too many resources to be paying for colleges. Yeah. My parents both migrated from Mexico, so they didn't really get to have a college education, more so even a high school education. My top choice school was the one that ended up giving me the most financial assistance. So my top choice school, UC Berkeley, actually selected me as a Regent Scholar, which means that I received a full ride scholarship. Knowing that a pandemic is something that's, like, super unforeseen and something that you can't necessarily prepare for, just seeing how a college reacts to the situation was really important to me. And so I would have to say it really actually did play a large role in the college that I chose. My best friend actually attends UC Berkeley, and I was asking them a lot of questions on how they're handling the situation, and he was telling me that UC Berkeley has made all their classes pass-fail for the semester because UC Berkeley is known to be a very rigorous academic institution. So, this situation obviously puts on a lot of stress on the students as well, and a lot of academic pressure, as well as, like, just pressure in general from their family life and all of those kind of things. So seeing that UC Berkeley made it pass-fail, making it much easier for the students and making it an even equal playing field for all the students, that was really reassuring to me. Me personally, it's been really stressful, I would say, because my parents are both very high risk. So it's been something that I've been having to really, like, make sure that they are safe and that we're keeping things clean and stuff like that. Just because my parents are older and sometimes, like, they tend to think, like, oh, like, we've been through things like this before. It's fine. It's nothing. It's just no blowover. And also, it has really been stressful for, like, the college decision process as well. Not necessarily choosing the college for me, but going through the process of, like, after I accept, then, like, the things that I have to do and, like, my financial aid situation and being in contact with officers and getting to know, like, the programs at the university while not actually being able to attend the university or missing out on the really informational student days and having to do things over Zoom. I was admitted into the university's STEM honors program, and that's supposed to be, like, a really big orientation, and we're supposed to have, like, we're supposed to meet the cohort of the other 25 students that are chosen, and we're supposed to start a summer program. But we sadly aren't able to, like, meet in person and do those projects that we were supposed to do, so we had to have our orientation over Zoom, and now we're going to be having our summer program at our own home, pretty much. So they're going to be sending us materials for, like, projects through the mail, and we're going to have to be using those and just kind of communicating over Zoom, over the phone, through emails. So that's been really stressful. Initially, I think that I was taking a very positive outlook on things, like constantly reminding myself, like, yeah, like, I don't really get to have the end of my senior year. However, like, at least, like, my family's healthy, I'm safe, I have food on my table. But there was one time that I was pretty stricken just because it was actually the UC Berkeley's orientation day, which is really known among students to be just like a fun day of celebration, and all the new bears are welcomed and there's a sense of cheers and you get to learn like all the campus traditions and get to go on like specific major-based tours, and like that was something I was really looking forward to. And I can't deny that I was actually really, that was like the first time I would say that I was like really, really sad to kind of be stuck in this situation.
My name is Daniela Frosto, and I am currently attending Woodlake High School. And I applied to 8 universities and got accepted to Fresno State University, Sacramento State University, and UC Merced. I'm feeling stressed and scared in a way because I don't know if my decision is going to be the right one, and I feel like I'm not the only senior that feels this way, because we definitely are limited to the resources that we have in regards to reaching out to the universities, since we can only virtually talk to them or join them in a webinar or Zoom call. But I definitely do think that if we were not in this pandemic, I would have much more resources to talk to people in person and to see the universities, to visit them, to actually go to their tours, to their preview days, which are all things that this year every senior missed out on. I was recently on a webinar with Fresno State University, and I asked if we would be starting off the year online or in school. They said that as of right now, they have planned to start the school year on just in school. But they do have resources to start online if that is what they are required to do. And I feel like a lot of us are scared because going into college, you definitely need that support and that motivation to be in a classroom environment, because that's what motivates you to get through your first year of college. And I feel like this is something very, very scary, especially for students who are not motivated through technology, not only because they don't find motivation to attend school on a laptop, but I feel like this has just affected our perspective on education, and we have seen and appreciated teachers much more now that we have been put into the situation. So I am scared to attend college my first year online, only because we haven't even started it and we don't know what to expect. I was hoping to have a job this summer. Unfortunately, that didn't work out due to this pandemic, and I feel like a lot of jobs were put on hold right now. And it's not something that we can control, but I definitely was planning on getting a job in order to prepare myself for college and to help myself in a financial factor. Since my parents didn't attend college, my motivation is set much higher because I want to make sure that at the end of the day, I'm putting myself first, but I'm also making my family proud. My parents don't have that knowledge in regards to college, but they do have a lot of knowledge in regards to life. And what they've always told me is that whatever I want to do, I can do it as long as I'm set to it.
You just heard from Selena Lopez-Curiel, Rogelio Chavez, and Daniela Frosto Santoyo. All are seniors at Woodlake High School. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. It's been 6 weeks now since California Governor Gavin Newsom issued a stay-at-home order to curb the spread of COVID-19. Since then, we've all been adapting to what has become our new normal and dealing with the complex feelings this new reality inspires. Author and former Fresno Bee columnist Armin Bacon is known for exploring her emotional life through her writing. She spoke to me from her home in Fresno about navigating our emotions in this strange time and the ways our reactions to COVID-19 resemble the grief process.
First of all, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for talking with us. How are you and your family doing?
Well, thanks so much for asking. You know, we're actually doing fine. Everybody's healthy. This is all so new and counterintuitive for us. We're people who like to hug and be close to our family and to our friends. And so it's all kind of a strange new world. But like everyone else, we're following the rules. We're sheltering in. We're being very vigilant about hand washing and social distancing and coping with this new abnormal, is what I prefer to call it. We have two New York doctors in our family, my sister and her husband. So from the very onset, we've taken this very seriously. We're trying to do our part to flatten the curve, and we're especially grateful for all of those people who are on the front lines risking their own lives in order to save ours. So there's a lot of emotions right now, and we're just hoping that we get to the other side of this, having learned some lessons and maintaining our health.
Absolutely. You know, there was a widely shared interview with grief expert David Kessler in the Harvard Business Review that was titled, "That Discomfort You're Feeling is Grief," in which he applied the stages of grief to this collective response that we're having to the pandemic. As someone who's written extensively about your grief journey following the death of your son, I'd love to hear your thoughts about our collective grief in the time of COVID-19.
Well, you know, I read the article too, and he had lots of very significant insights. For people who don't know, he does refer to the stages of grief, which there are five traditional ones: denial, this isn't really happening; anger, which in our case now, anger over canceled plans, over people getting sick, over, you know, maybe there's not going to be a graduation or a wedding has to be postponed. The third stage is bargaining. The fourth is depression, and he says the fifth is acceptance. What I loved is that he's added a sixth stage, which is finding meaning, which I think, you know, I'm huge on that. I'm trying to look back and, you know, is there a teachable moment in all this that we will emerge better and not bitter from this experience? It's interesting because this pandemic is delivering a multitude of griefs and lots of grief triggers. It's not just human loss, which of course is the largest grief we can experience as a society, but there's grief over job loss, over loss of the normal life we're accustomed to living, the grief about not knowing when this is going to end, and there's the loss of that human connection, again, not being able to wrap your arms around the people you love and not being able to be close to friends and be next to each other and making eye contact. And I think that makes us all very sad. That triggers a lot of grief. I call it complicated grief, because it's not just brought on by one thing. It's lots and lots of layers, which then requires us to be very mindful of how we're feeling and to take extraordinary care of ourselves, because it's very easy when all of this is happening to slip into that hopeless rabbit hole. And I know what that feels like. And it's, you know, I mean, it's a natural, I think, thing to do, but collectively, it can cause us great harm. So there are lots of things I think we should be doing to help mitigate that.
You know, I'd like to come back to this idea of grief, and here's some of the thoughts that you have about the gifts that it has to offer us. You know, grief isn't something that we often talk about as a society, but it's something we all experience. And you have written that grief is something that is both defining and transformative. What do you mean by that?
First of all, grief, almost any kind of grief, I think changes us on a cellular level. You're never the same after you've experienced profound grief. In our book, Griefland, I wrote, walking through the fire will either melt or illuminate you. And ultimately, I think it does both to us. It can make us more human. And there are some griefs. I think it makes us realize how precious and fragile life is. So it gives us this appreciation for being alive and for having each other. Already we have seen so many higher levels of kindness and compassion, you know, people donating their plasma after being sick on their own deathbed, people donating services and money. I say that it's transformative because I think it helps us laser focus on what matters most. I think that people are rethinking their priorities. I think we are all rediscovering our most basic human needs of family and shelter and food and taking care of ourselves. I think that there's a beauty in the simplicity that we're all having to return to, and a raised consciousness about how precious and fragile life truly is. We had grown accustomed, I think, to living in this rush hour of our digitized life and navigating life at light speed. And all of a sudden, many of us have time on our hands. So it's a beautiful time for reflection about thinking, who is the person I want to be and what changes do I need to make in order to find that person and rediscover her? And the goal, I think, for all of us at this point is not only survival, but resilience and finding a balance in our day and in our life. So keeping connected with the people we love and care about, even if we can't be wrapping our arms around them, but we can certainly be reaching out to them. We can be talking to them by phone or through technology, and then taking good care of ourselves, making sure that we're eating healthy, that we're getting some exercise, and that we're staying centered and balanced.
That's such good advice, now more than ever, but really at any time. So I'd like to talk to you a bit about emotions that we all are feeling. So I personally had a moment recently where I got really angry about something that normally wouldn't bother me at all. And when I sat with that feeling, I realized that the emotion that was fueling my anger was actually sadness. Both for how this pandemic is changing my life, but also for all the other people that are hurting so much more than I am. And what I came to realize, I think, is that because I'm so fortunate to have shelter and food and can continue to work and be productive, I hadn't allowed myself to feel the full range of my emotional response to this moment. So I guess my question to you is this: because I have so much to be grateful for, do I even have the right to be sad?
Well, of course, the answer to that question is yes, but let me just back up a little bit by reminding us all that we're kind of falling into two groups. There's the one group that this crisis is just sucker punching. I mean, it's that people who don't have shelter, who don't have food, who are struggling because they are ill, maybe they're in the hospital or they have a family member who is critically ill. And we see that group. And then there's this other group. And I think both of us fall into this group. We are able to work remotely from home. We do have shelter and food. We're reasonably healthy. And so we feel a little guilty about complaining about this. And the reality is, first of all, it's not business as usual for any of us. So we all have a range of emotions that we're trying to work our way through. And the most important thing, I think, is that we have to acknowledge the feelings. They're real. And it's okay for you or me or anybody to be feeling sadness or anger or feeling out of sorts. My advice would be, you know, try not to get too far out in front of the day, projecting onto next year. I have friends who are worrying about next Christmas. Gosh, I wonder if I'm going to be able to host the holidays. And it's like, no. Let's reimagine normal in the present tense. And already, I mean, believe it or not, we've all made some pretty significant adjustments. And I think we're doing pretty well. We're finding substitutes or equivalents for the time being anyway, for seeing our friends, for seeing our grandchildren, for getting exercise and doing meals. Instead of going out to dinner, we're staying at home and reinventing, you know, family cookbooks and going through old recipes of ours. So the biggest thing is, I think we need to get up every morning, make a plan, get dressed. And, you know, here's my mantra. I get up every morning and I whisper to myself, today I'm going to give the world the best I have to offer. And that may mean checking in with my aunties and uncles, my elders. That may mean calling my girlfriends. It may be sitting down with my husband and having a real talk about what the rest of the week looks like and make sure he's doing okay. Or baking cookies and delivering them in the neighborhood, leaving them on doorsteps. I mean, everybody, I think this is a time to find purpose and to also rekindle whatever passions we have, because most of us have a little extra time. And so if you're a musician or an artist or a painter or a writer, this is your time to spend a little more energy on that. But it's okay to be feeling all those emotions. And I think it would be not so normal if we weren't feeling them.
So before we wrap up, what are the lessons you think this crisis might offer us?
Well, I think for me, the biggest lesson is that it's our lives don't have to be filled 24/7. That quiet time is time to be appreciated and relished. I have revisited music. I'm reading more books. I'm just being more mindful of my own self. And I think some of us busy ourselves to avoid looking inside internally and taking stock of ourselves. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about what changes I want to make in my life. And, you know, for the longest time, I said, I'm going to be walking in the neighborhood because I work out in a gym usually. And finally, this pandemic has forced me, because I can't go to the gym, to get outside and walk and find the beauty of the trees and the flowers and the insects that are all around us. And so I'm learning that simple is sometimes better, and that quiet is sometimes better than noise, and that staying at home and cooking and taking my time chopping vegetables is better than going to a restaurant. And I have forgotten all those things. And so I'm just, I think, more aware of life's beauty and simplicity and getting back to basics. I know my mother, when she was living, always used to talk about her family's victory garden and how beautiful it was watching vegetables grow. And it's like, a vegetable garden, what a novel idea. Mm-hmm. And so I think where I'm returning, I mean, you know, I'm also pulling out all my mom's old Armenian recipes. And I'm doing a FaceTime once a week with my sisters and my nieces and my daughter. And we're all cooking kind of the old fashioned way and sending each other pictures and kind of encouragement. And it's lovely. And that's something we really never used to do. And so I think we're reinventing ourselves. And that's not something I really thought I would be doing during this juncture or this chapter of my life. And I'm enjoying it quite a bit. So I think there are lots of lessons that we can all learn from what we're going through right now. And some of them are painful and some of them are simple and beautiful.
Armin Bacon, it's been a joy talking with you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, and please take good care of yourself. Keep washing your hands and social distancing, but I look forward to seeing you in person one of these days soon, I hope.
As do I. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kathleen. Thank you.
But if the world was ending, you come over, right? You come over and you stay the night. Would you love me for the hell of it? All our fears would be irrelevant. If the world was ending, you come over, right? The sky be falling while I hold you tight. No, there wouldn't be a reason why we would even have to say goodbye. If the world was ending, you come over, right? You come over, you come over, you come over, right? If the world was ending, you come over, right?
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. As we go into the weekend, we wanted to leave you with a new tune and maybe some inspiration. Fresno musician Eva Scow has been sheltering in place, like the rest of us, but says she's using the time to write more of her own music. She just released a song called Mambo on YouTube, where she plays all of the instruments. Valley Public Radio's Laura Satsui spoke with Scow and put together this audio postcard with Scow's music.
So in Mambo, I play my primary instrument, which is the mandolin. I'm using a Godin electric mandolin. I also play a tenor five-string electric mandolin by Jonathan Mann. I play the electric bass, I play the shaker, I play some cymbals and various drum and sticks, and I play the desk, actually, this old campaign desk that I have in my house. I figured it was going to sound great to record that sound, and it kind of resembles like a dancer, like heels on a wooden platform. Obviously, for the performance aspect of being a musician, it's not great because there's little to no performance, live performance happening except for the online platforms that people are using that you see, which is really great still. But on the other side, it's really great for personal enrichment of practicing and developing your voice on composition. Every musician is different. You know, everybody has things that they want to work on. And for me, I've always wanted to continue to develop my voice as a songwriter. I play the mandolin, so most of the songs that I play are written by other people. So I feel like that's kind of one of the ultimate things as a musician is to really be able to play your own music and develop your voice there. I came up with the little riff, so to speak, at the beginning of the song a long time ago with that initial melody on top. But recently I've kind of added more stuff to the composition. And because of the shelter in place, I was able to like really focus for like a week on recording and developing the harmony, getting a recording down. As a musician, I'm always hearing like little melodies, short melodies. Sometimes those stay with you longer than a few minutes or something, you know, and sometimes you're able to remember them later, or in this case, I, you know, recorded it on my phone. And then from there, you come back and listen to it a day later, say, and now you have another melody to add on top of it. You really just have to, like, sit on it. I think that's, like, if you have the time, which we all have the time, you can really, like, develop something, you know, over time that I think you're happy with for a long time. I definitely miss the interaction with other musicians on the bandstand, you know, just the interaction between two or however many musicians That happens when we play together live. But I know this is not forever, and I know that before we know it, we'll be back together. And hopefully it'll be kind of like a rejuvenation, you know? This time will be like rejuvenating for everybody, and when we get back together to play, for everyone, not just musicians, but the listeners as well, everybody will kind of be in a different space and maybe appreciative and with more gratitude and different outlook a little bit. Ultimately, I just hope that people get some sort of enjoyment out of music, whether it's my music or any music. I think that's kind of like the biggest gift that music gives to people is just like pure enjoyment, pure joy. And so I always hope that somebody at least is inspired or enjoying, you know, the music. Aside from that, I really can't expect anything else. I hope everybody is doing well during these times and able to enjoy music and maybe have it be a little bit of an escape from their current situation.
That was Eva Scow playing all of the instruments on her composition Mambo. You could also watch her perform the piece on her YouTube channel. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all of this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Laura Satsui, and Madi Bolaños. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, standing with all Californians as we address the coronavirus emergency together on the web at chcf.org.